And now we're speaking with Dr. Mads Gilbert, a Norwegian specialist in anesthesiology, professor and head of the Department of Emergency Medicine at the University Hospital of North Norway, member of the Norwegian Aid Committee, and recipient of the Northern Norwegian of the Year Award for leading the medical team that revived a woman pronounced clinically dead. So, Dr. Gilbert, we're very grateful that you could join us today. I'd love to ask how you're doing, or maybe I should ask, where are you exactly today?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. It's really a pleasure to talk to your audience. And right now I'm sitting in the far north of North Norway on actually 70 degrees northern latitude, which is about the same latitude as Baffin Island. I am in Tromsø, which is the northernmost university city in the world, actually. And I'm sitting in my study room, and I'm preparing for my tour to Canada and the United States.
Well, I've been seeing advertisements for your tour on Facebook and on email lists. I know there's a lot of people who are excited to see it and are waiting for you to come. And it's interesting that we're interviewing you from McMaster University, because McMaster has a large or significant medical school and a medical research program. So people could be very well attending your talk for all sorts of reasons, to learn about the humanitarian situation, the medical situation in Gaza, the politics. It all sounds very interesting. And I understand you were one of only two foreign doctors allowed into Gaza during Operation Cast Lead. So I'd like to know, how is it that you were allowed into Gaza?
Well, let me just first make a little note on McMaster, because it's really a very important university, and I'm well familiar with the innovative teaching program of Peace Through Health. And I've just been studying and reading that textbook, which you have edited, I believe, at McMaster. Also, the study plan, the curriculum, and the way you teach medical students at McMaster is well known and has been quite a model for us here at the University of Tromsø. I do a lot of teaching of medical students myself, so I'm very excited to go and see our mentors at McMaster. Going back to Gaza, well, yes, Dr. Erik Fosse, who is a cardiothoracic surgeon, and myself, we have been working with the Palestinians in their medical systems, and in particular the emergency services, for more than 15 years in Gaza. So we know Gaza well, and we have many colleagues and friends there. And when the Israelis started their assault on the 27th of December last year, we immediately decided to set up an emergency surgical team and go to support them, because we wanted to stand shoulder to shoulder with them in that very difficult situation. So we got financial and political support from the Norwegian government, and we went through Cairo and El Arish and managed to get into Gaza on New Year's Eve last year. And we stayed for 12 days and night at Shifa Hospital and worked as doctors. We were the only, as you said, foreign doctors allowed in. As you may recall, Gaza was and still is completely besieged by the Israeli army and air force and navy. Nothing is allowed in and nothing is allowed out, so to say. And the international community, which now rightly so are rushing to help the people hit by the Port-au-Prince earthquake, were not allowed into Gaza. So it was a weird situation, because we wanted to work as doctors, and yet we also had to answer the innumerable requests from the media to give accounts and tell about the situation, because, as you also may recall, Western media were not allowed into Gaza by the same Israeli government that attacked the Palestinians in Gaza.
Wow. Well, you've brought up a number of interesting points. On what you were saying earlier about McMaster, I've taken a peace studies course at McMaster. It's related to what you were describing, and I know many people in those departments and programs. They often help in activities we plan. So it's great that you are involved with that. And as for McMaster's medical program, my sister actually is in pre-med right now. She hopes to attend here as well. So it's wonderful that you have such a knowledge of this, and certainly. I mean, you were very knowledgeable about the situation in Gaza, or very enthusiastic coming into the situation, but it was a very dire situation. And I understand the outside world was really dependent on you and the other doctor to learn what was happening. But when you first were present in Gaza when the operation started, I wonder what your first impressions were of the situation, perhaps from what you could get by speaking with people in Gaza or what you're hearing discussed around you. What was your introduction to Operation Cast Lead?
Actually, it was the fierce bombing at the border station of Rafah in the southern part of Gaza, on the border between Gaza, occupied Palestine, and Egypt, because we tried to get in on December 13th, the day before New Year's Eve, but we had to rush away from the border because Israeli F-16 jet fighters were bombing extremely close to the border station. So that was the first impression, and then the next day, as we were allowed through the border by the Egyptian border police and soldiers, we rushed with an ambulance up along the coast road, and we saw the extent of the bombing, we saw the extent of destruction, and once we entered Gaza City, we saw these endless lines of people standing queuing up to try to get a piece of bread. I had just left Gaza, actually. I was there teaching at the Al-Azhar University only 6 weeks previous to the attack starting. And I was very worried because of the extensive effects of the long-lasting siege. And what we could see and what was extremely worrisome was, of course, that this extremely exhausted population, already on their knees from the long-lasting siege, were now bombed continuously. There was no electricity, there was scarce water, there was almost no food, and once we got to Shifa, the patients just were pouring in, endless lines of people coming, crawling, walking, taken in taxis, in private cars, in ambulances, and all sorts of horrific injuries, which I will talk more about during my lecture. So I will try to give you the full picture of what we experienced, and not to forget what the Palestinians experienced and still experience in Gaza.
Yes, this is why people have to attend your lecture. You were a link to the outside world about what was happening there, and you still are today. I'm wondering, when you were in Gaza, in terms of press or media, what outlets did you have available to be able to speak to the rest of the world?
You know, when we say that there were no journalists in or no media people in Gaza, that is a serious mistake. And it's sort of an old colonial style of looking at the world, because at any given time there are around 600 well-trained professional Palestinian and Arab journalists in Gaza. But they are, quote-unquote, the locals, and they, in a way, they don't count for the Western world. They want the white journalists to be there. So this misconception that we were the only ones covering for the media stems from this perception that you have to be white to be a credible source. Given that situation, actually, we had a number of extremely dedicated and clever people following us. Those were the Palestinian journalists and the Arab journalists covering for Press TV, Al Jazeera, El Arabiya, and the other stations, and also covering for CNN and CBS and BBC and all the other international networks. So every time we were on the screen, on the television or on the radio, there were always some clever and courageous Palestinian or other Arab journalists holding the microphone, doing the filming, making the connection with the satellites, and facilitating our capacity to talk to the world.
I see. So you were one of the few people that was actually being listened to in the outside world rather than one of the few people reporting on it, because there, of course, were many talented and capable reporters, but there was a greater willingness to listen perhaps to Europeans or North Europeans on the situation because of the prejudices that you described. That's a very important insight that you bring into this. This just reminds me, we interviewed an Islamic Relief staffer. His name was Hatem Sharab, during the bombardment. So during Operation Cast Lead, we conducted a live interview to Gaza to speak with the staffer for Islamic Relief. And one of the things I noticed was that he appeared to be concerned about his personal safety because of the bombardment, the scale of the violence. I'm wondering, did you feel that there was danger around you, or did you feel that you were concerned about your personal safety?
Well, you know, having decided to go there voluntarily, we knew what we were doing. We have been working with war surgery and been in conflict zones all over the world, so we are pretty decisive about what we're doing. Once we go there, we know that we take a certain personal risk, which is, by the way, much less than the risk the locals are forced to take, because we can leave. We have our Norwegian red passports. We can go anywhere we like in the world. The Palestinians, the 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza, they have nowhere to flee. So they are the persons that we should be concerned about regarding safety and security, because they are still in a very difficult situation as we are speaking. But of course, there was continuous bombing. They were bombing very close to the Shifa Hospital. We heard the bombing, the drones, all the time. And when you see all these maimed and torn apart and dying and killed people of all ages, both sexes, civilians, old men, young children, infants, being so incredibly destroyed, being so cruelly taken away from life, even if you are a professional doctor, you know that the same could happen to you if you take a hit. And we knew that we were in danger, but that was a calculated risk. We trusted our hosts. We trusted that we know the area and the situation. The unpredictable factor was, of course, the way the Israelis were conducting their attacks. They were attacking everything: ambulances, hospitals, schools, UN cars. Any target was a free target for them. So that added to the feeling of insecurity. And we had some situations with very serious threats towards Shifa Hospital also, but we decided to stay, and we knew the risks.
Are you saying that...
I'd like to add that all the time in these situations, when you do what I call solidarity medicine, you are extremely well cared for by the local people. They look at you as their most precious jewel, and they always take precautions and sort of do whatever they can to safeguard your safety.
So there were relief operations at the time. Are you suggesting that they were being endangered by the bombardment or just a general military operation?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. There were a number of medical staff killed and injured. They killed UN-employed truck drivers who were driving UN trucks with food. They attacked UN shelters with UN personnel trying to take care of civilians. So, and this you can read about in the Goldstone report. It was absolutely dangerous to be a relief worker also. It was dangerous to be in Gaza altogether. Just being there was dangerous.
Now,
because you never knew what they would hit.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm thinking in terms of the publicity material that I viewed for your tour, I wasn't able to ascertain this exactly, but were you allowed or able to practice medicine and help any of the victims of the bombing?
Oh, yes. We were working as doctors all the time. But, you know, Shifa is a big hospital. It has 410 doctors and 600 nurses, and it's sort of a university-level hospital, but they're lacking everything, and they were lacking everything. And given the flow of patients and the number of casualties coming in, of course, this was a complete medical disaster. It was a humanitarian disaster. And it's important to bear in mind that this was not an earthquake. This was man-made, 100% man-made disaster. We worked all the time. We worked not as much as 24 hours a day, because we had to rest. We had to have our 4 hours of sleep. We tried to get that, but otherwise we were doing clinical work. Eric was doing surgery. I was doing resuscitation, anesthesia, pain relief, and worked in team with the Palestinian doctors. So a lot of my lecture will be about the medical effects of the modern type of warfare that Israel is conducting, which, by the way, is not very different from the medical effects of for example, the U.S. Army warfare on civilian targets like in Iraq.
Well, you know, from what you've told me, it sounds as if not only do you have an extensive medical understanding of what occurred, but you also have an extensive moral or psychological understanding or political understanding of what's happening in Gaza as well. So I can strongly recommend your tour to everyone. And I was just wondering, on this tour, is there any sort of general message that you wanted to get across to audiences?
I think the important, the most important message is that I think everybody has a voice, and everybody can change, can participate in changing the world for a better direction. And I think what happened in Gaza and what still happens in occupied Palestine is an attack on our most fundamental humanitarian platform, which we like to think that the Western world is sort of standing on. Because what's happening in Gaza now and what we saw in December, January last year was an attack on fundamental human rights. And it opened a very worrisome feeling that the Palestinians are stamped out as some sort of secondary creatures, not human beings. They are Untermensch, they are under people, they are quote-unquote terrorists or Hamas or Jihad, whatever you call them. And it seems like the Israeli government and the Israeli military forces apply another morality and another standard to the way they treat the Palestinians as they would have done if they were treating other people. And this, of course, in 2010 is an extreme challenge to all of us who believe in human rights, who believe in international law, and who believe in the fact that even in conflict there are certain rules and regulations that should be obeyed. They were all violated and stepped on by the Israelis during the attack on Gaza. And we have to take responsibility. That's my point. Everyone has to take responsibility for the world we're living in, and everybody has a voice.
Yes, in the English-speaking world, from the UK to Canada and the US, I think more and more people are coming to understand what exactly happened during Operation Cast Lead and what the situation is with the Palestinians. And people like you have been contributing very much to that understanding. So I thank you very much for coming on the program with us today.
Thank you very much.